I'm recording the call, so please be aware of that because we do record the calls to be put up on the meeting site. Now, before we start, we have to talk about the antitrust policy, Hyperledger wants us to be aware of the fact that we act in competitive ways so that we do not risk any antitrust action. For more information, you can read the stuff, the antitrust policy details from the meeting agenda. That's one. Second is everybody is welcome here. There is a code of conduct that ensures that people interact with each other with respect and dignity. It is okay not to agree with people, but do so in a reasoned and respectful way. So we have that out of the way. Let's, first thing I wanna wish everyone a happy Thanksgiving, since it's so in the US tomorrow and many institutions are off. The second thing I want to say is we'll just quickly go down the list and introduce ourselves just so that we know why we are all here. That's the first thing. Second is, please keep it very short. You know, you don't have to introduce yourself if you do not want to. Keep it short. 10 seconds, 20 seconds, that's about it. So I go down the list. Roland?
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is Roland Faure. I work for Aerosurte, a consulting company specialist in air freight.
Okay, great.
In France.
Amit? If you do not want to, you can skip. Ankita? Ankita?
Hi. It's Ankita.
Great. Anything more you wish to say?
I'm working with Ironworks. So we mainly work on digital identity solutions. So closely with Indy and more want to explore the areas with which we are coming up.
Great. Who's the next on the list? Let me see. It keeps jumping around. There are 17 participants, so we want to go through this very fast. I want to see whether Stefan is around. Is Stefan here? Can you please introduce yourself?
Yes, good afternoon or good morning. I'm Stefan Mouy. I'm a financial consultant. I'm involved. I'm based in Paris, France. I'm involved with the EU Commission. And I'm supposed to talk a little bit about the FATF draft digital identity guidance.
Okay. Who's next? I thought I saw Kalia.
Hi, Bipin and everybody.
Identity woman. I work I've run something called the Internet Identity Workshop, and I am active across a huge range of groups in the space.
Yeah, Kalia is very active in multiple spaces, and she's very knowledgeable. So please ask her about anything related to identity. Bakkenheimer?
Dan Bakkenheimer here. So in standard space, I'm the ISO SE37 liaison officer to TC307. So that's the biometrics liaison officer to blockchain for ISO. I'm active in APA, in MOBI, in a few. And I guess the most interesting project I'm working on is the World Economic Forum Known Traveler Digital Identity, where hopefully by this spring we'll have real people using indie-based, verifiable credentials to cross the border with Canada and Netherlands government involved in the pilot, and three airports and two airlines. So it should be interesting.
Great. Now, I don't see everybody's... some people do not want to want to introduce themselves, but others do. So please go down the list. If you're not been, if you have not introduced yourself, just go down the list, please.
Hi, Vipin. This is Kalyan. I'm one of the co-founders with Ironworks, and we have been focused specifically on self-sovereign identity from last more than a year now. And we have been delivering solutions to our global customers on identity space here. So pretty much into the identity space actively from last few months here.
Beautiful. Next.
I work with Istio Future Tech as a VP technology. So recently, become the sovereign steward and exploring the identity and identity solutions for a couple of customers.
Beautiful. Who's on next?
Z here. I'm working with a group in Zambia doing land rights project. That's why I'm here.
Todd.
Todd Gerke. I'm a blockchain solutions architect with Luxoft. We've been doing integrating SSI into projects for the last 3 years.
Who's on next?
Hi, this is Nipin. I'm working with Jio, a telecom company in India, and I look after their India stack implementation.
Hi, everyone. This is Ravikant Agrawal. I work with Infosys Consulting, based out of Pune, India. I've been exploring identity SSR since last 1 year. So more for share and learn here.
Beautiful. Who's on next? Hopefully we'll get through it in about 2 or 3 minutes. Anyone else that I'm missing? Drummond, is he there? Lasse, Deutsche Börse.
Listening in to learn more about decentralized identity.
Basically, I'm working on Hyperledger Indy, crypto blockchain technologies.
Done.
Pippin, how are you?
All right.
Very good. Sorry, I'm late. I knew that call might go long.
All right. So we're just introducing ourselves. It's just a quick thing.
All right. Would you like me to do that? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, if you want to.
Sure, very quickly. Drummond Reed, I'm Chief Trust Officer at Evernym and a trustee and chair of the Governance Frame Working Group at the Sovereign Foundation. And I work on the DID spec.
Kelly?
I'm taking notes.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll introduce Kelly. She's been involved in the education space, and she's very active in multiple communities, and she's volunteering a lot, and you know, and contributing to multiple projects. Swapnali.
Yeah, hi. I'm also working with the Ayan Works, and currently we are working on Hyperledger ND projects and SSI.
All right. I think we should dive into Stefan's presentation right away. I had some notes that I had basically just scribbled from the site on.
Yep. Can everybody hear me?
ETF. Yeah.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Can I share a screen, maybe? If this works for everybody, can you see a screen or?
Yep. Looks great.
Okay. This is basically what I'm supposed to talk very briefly. I gather I've got 7 minutes, right? So it's going to be a fairly focused presentation. After months of preparation, the FATF has finally released its draft guidance on digital identity. Again, we spoke about this in previous discussion. It's a fairly important document because basically it's the first time there's a concerted effort to discuss digital identity implications for the financial sector, and more critically for the anti-money laundering regulations affecting financial institutions. So you have the document is available for consultation. You can still comment it, but I'm afraid there's virtually no time left. The deadline, I think, is this coming Friday. So it's going to be, you're very welcome to discuss it. You will see that there are a number of areas of focus. where feedback is more important is requested. Typically, this deals with how I think there's an underlying theme, because digital identity are viewed rightly so, I believe, as a good way to stimulate financial inclusion. And at the same time, one of the constraints of financial inclusion is that identity proofing can be difficult, especially in emerging countries, but not only in emerging countries, a number of more mature countries as well. And the FATF is looking at ways to lower the requirements for identity proofing by kind of balancing those with higher requirements for authentication and transaction monitoring. So there is a lot of discussion about that in the document, and you can see that some of the questions that are being raised by the FATF relate to what sort of risks are involved, how can you mitigate those risks, and whether in fact there is any trade-off between identity proofing level of assurance and authentication and transaction monitoring processes. So. If you are not fully the document, I really would recommend you take a look at it, because it's now in pretty good shape. It's much more refined compared to previous versions, and basically it's accessible to. It gives a fairly broad overview of what the current situation is in many countries. So if you are not that familiar with, I would say, the level of issues that are related to how, you know, what anti-money laundering and terrorist financing prevention risks are involved, and how digital identity solutions can operate, it's a good way to look at the document. There is another aspect of the document which is also worth considering. The document includes the so-called decision process for regulated entity. I have highlighted the page of the report that really deals with that. That's probably the most critical part of the whole report. And basically what it says is, it's set up as a series of three questions. One is there a digital ID system that has been authorized by government for use in banking or financial sector? And you can see that, of course, if the answer is yes, you go straight to use it. If the answer is no, then you jump to the second question, which is, do you know the assurance level or level of assurance, LOI? And if you do know and the level of assurance of the digital ID system, then you come to a third question, which is that level of assurance sufficient for the type of risks that are involved in the customer relationship that is being contemplated? And you can see that if depending on whether you come to a yes or no solution, it basically has quite clear indications. So central to this whole thing is the concept of level assurance, which is something that is a notion that is reflected in the NIST guidelines, but also the EIDAS regulation in Europe. It doesn't mean that if you do not know if there is no established level of assurance, you cannot use the ID system, but then there's a fairly onerous requirement, which is to perform or obtain an assurance assessment. So effectively, any digital ID system that is contemplating being used by financial institution or the financial sector as a whole will have to one way or another to obtain a level of assurance. How that is obtained, how that is performed, there's still a lot of I would say flexibility and room for maneuver. But it's important to realize that this is the core, I would say, thinking and decision process behind the use of digital IDs. I think that's really it from my from this point.
So, Kalia has a question here, which is, can the LOA be enhanced? Her question is very different. It says, does the document, what I take it to mean, does the FATF understand emerging DID technologies, or is it predisposed to other types of technologies?
Why don't you just read my question? Incomplete, which is, how does the document understand the emerging decentralized identity technologies as a way to do identity proofing, or is it entirely oriented and predisposed to the phone home centralized ID systems?
That's an interesting question. The document is viewed or is meant to be, I'm not absolutely sure it's totally it totally achieves that, but it's meant to be technology neutral. Okay, in other words, the document does not advocate one particular ID solution compared to another, and the document does not even advocate one particular level of assurance for standard banking transactions. Okay. So coming back to your question, I think is it consistent or is it usable with self-sovereign ID solutions? In principle, the answer I think is yes. Okay. But of course, that means that those solutions will have to be somehow LOA rated, and it's that probably where the difficulty starts.
Yeah, I think we should move on to the next speaker, but I think this should remain as a question. Since most of the regulatory agencies, like SEC, for example, operates on a technology neutral basis. That means it's rule based. That means you've got to have a way of proving LOA, a way of proving that the person who is on is really the person who's supposed to be getting the
right. And I think an important point here that's universal in identity assurance level, not verification assurance level, as NIST 863 delineates, is that for the highest level of assurance, in-person proofing is required. So it, as you're saying, it is technology independent, but regardless, if you want the highest level of
That is not true.
No, that's not true.
That is not true.
No.
IAL3, physical presence is required for identity proofing, period.
No,
talking about 863.3.
Yeah, but then once you have the credential, you can use it.
Well, I can tell you that's not true. I'm not saying it's not true under the NIST standard, but it's not true as a statement. You can have high LOA identity proofing that is made now on a remote basis with biometric solutions.
Maybe for other countries, but it wouldn't fly for U.S. government.
Well,
I mean, that's what everybody's working on currently, to be honest.
cost of proofing and how to get rid of it. How do you prove again and again and again?
It's not costly, actually. It's, solutions do exist.
No, I'm saying the in-person proofing has proven to be costly and also...
Yes. Now, could you reuse that? Yes, and that's what we're doing with KDTI, for example. Because I have an e-passport, I was proofed by my government, and I could use that as a basically derived credential. But if I'm not known to the entity, and I want to go through an identity proofing process, at least in the U.S., according to 863.3, physical presence is required for identity proofing. Period. No question about it. Period.
Okay.
Well, that's not a universal rule. Let's put it this way.
That's right. Fair enough.
We are talking about the FATF recommendations, which are universally applicable. And they
right.
Are,
and my question that I submitted is, they say that it should be appropriate for use in customer due diligence, but they never define what appropriate for use in customer due diligence is.
That's because I can tell you why. Because there's a fairly fundamental principle which is enshrined in anti-money laundering regulation, which is so-called the risk-based approach, and that basically says each financial institution has to look at the customer relationship in separation of others and assess what the risk is involved, and therefore it's only after that risk determination that you define what is the level of assurance that you need, right? In other words, you will not treat exactly in the same way a retired person who's been living in the same place, has a stable pension, with someone who just arrived, has a fly-by-night business, right? I mean, that's obvious, stating the obvious.
And the other dimension is the transaction that you're involved in. If you're buying a pizza for $10, you're not going to be tested to the same level
as you are
if you are doing some high-value transactions.
That's, I mean, there are a number of factors.
Yes. So anyway, we leave it at that for now, because these are...
If I could, there's one other really interesting thing that that is left unanswered that I highlighted back to them. They talk about the information required to be collected in order to resolve to a unique individual within a given population or context. Now, having worked on India's Aadhaar program, the way to uniquely identify individuals within that population of 1.3 billion individuals was using face, finger, and iris to deduplicate that population. I don't know how they intend to resolve to a unique individual within a given population or context without the use of biometric identifiers. So
I understand, sir. You're a biometrics person. Yeah. The point is that there have been several studies conducted which says that if you have multiple data points, there are, you know, certain levels of assurance, like, you know, 95% with 10 factors. If you have 20 factors, it goes even as high as 99.9%. So there are various ways of slicing that, that problem. Since you mentioned Aadhaar, the next person who's going to talk about this is going to be Nitin. So he's going to talk about that, the India stack, and the whole thing is rooted in biometrics, which in our country, in the US, has had a lot of pushback on biometrics, but people do submit to biometrics if they want to get on a frequent, like a easy flyer program, things like that. But anyway, be that as it may, I think, Nitin, you should present what you can about India Stack and Digital Locker in particular.
I have, are you able to see my screen?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So I have two presentations. One is on Digital Locker, and one is on Account Aggregator, which is a consent framework. So I'll try. I mean, I think 30 minutes should be short to actually cover both. So I'll try to cover Digital
Locker.
Let's
do the consent later. Okay. Let's concentrate on Digital Locker.
Okay. So overall, in terms of India Stack, we talk about India Stack. The identity piece has been provided by Aadhaar. And over that, there are multiple platforms that has been envisaged, and a complete ecosystem is planned to be built on that. And one of the objective of the whole India Stack ecosystem is paperless. So ensuring that the entire support or entire system of presenting paper to avail a service can be eliminated. So that's where the Digital Locker comes in, and in fact, I was one of the. It was started in Maharashtra, and a state in India, Maharashtra, and I was part of the first version of that Digital Locker, and then it was adopted all over India. So it evolved from there, and now it has quite caught up with many government services coming onto it, and that has been possible with active support from the governments, various state governments and the federal government. So the whole ecosystem is based on the open API ecosystem, if we talk about participants, so There are basically four participants. So we call them issuers, requesters, or digital locker service providers, and repositories. So how it works is basically a issuer can be any entity who issues a document, and there are certain guidelines on what kind of electronic document we are talking about. There has to be certain metadata, basic metadata. There has to be a unique document ID for that particular issuer, and it has to actually go through a partnership agreement with the authority, which is called a Digital Locker Authority, which is owned by the federal government. A requester is an entity which is providing any service to the citizen or any private entity who requires certain documents, like for example, opening a bank account. So you might require a proof of identity and proof of address. So you become a requester, because then you can, once you partner as a requester, you can access Digital Locker and retrieve document from that. You can access those APIs. I'll come to the APIs later, but you will have access to those APIs. So issuers and requesters are partners. Apart from that, the service provider area, we have Digital Locker service providers and repositories. So typically, repositories are where the documents are stored, and they issue a unique resource identifier, URI, for that document. Those repositories can be owned by issuers, or there can be a private players who actually provide services to the issuer to store their documents. So if you talk about cloud paradigm or issuer maintaining their own secure storage, depending on the risk assessment of the issuer, we can have both the models there. It's very simple that there is only one copy, one single sort of source of truth that is stored in the repository, and what flows is the URI. So one is the issued document, which for which the URIs are stored in the Digital Locker, and the repositories actually store the centralized repositories store the document. Second part is that there are a lot of legacy documents which users already have. So the Digital Lockers can provide a service where users can upload those documents and get it e-signed, electronic signed. We have a service called electronic signing, which is based again on Aadhaar, which is an online digital signing service. And you can self-attest those documents while sharing. So you have both the options for legacy. You can actually scan it, upload it, and digitally sign it. From a certain date onwards, when any entity becomes an issuer, they can issue electronic documents and publish a URI. So if we talk about this whole India Stack ecosystem, so we are talking about multiple transformations. And those transformations are based on certain layers, like for example, presenceless. So once we had that Aadhaar implemented, it provides an ability.
The biometric identity comes in for the presenceless layer. That is the base layer.
And over it, we have a paperless layer, because it uses Aadhaar again to actually authenticate on a digital locker, to access the documents and do a eKYC, which is opening a bank account and all those things. So you don't have to present a paper there anywhere. Then we have, of course, now UPI is again based on JAM Trinity, Jandan, that is a mobile and Aadhaar and a bank account. So all those layers, Aadhaar enabled payment services. So when Aadhaar is linked to the account, it enables that, the ability to do cashless transactions based on Aadhaar and biometric. And there is a consent layer, which actually we have started with account aggregator, which is my next presentation, possibly in next session, let's see. The consent is that it is a non-reputable consent before sharing any data. So that layer is also in the works. And on that, we have various platforms, which is a GSTN platform that has come up. There are use cases for cash flow lending that is being implemented. There are investments which is completely online. You can start a mutual fund completely online through eKYC, and you can start account and start investing. And there are other many things you can actually track. So So if you talk about paperless here, layer, the digital locker actually falls in that layer, which actually enables that part. So this is a kind of an interface where you can actually sign up or sign in, and you can start with your mobile a number. You create a complete account, and there is a Aadhaar eKYC verification. So when you sign in next time, either you can use a username password. Username would be your key identifier or Aadhaar. Username is always linked to Aadhaar. Of course, you can link it at your leisure time. I mean, it is not mandatory to link it, but once you link it, it actually enables you to retrieve a lot of documents issued by a lot of government or federal government and state government issuers. So because once they issue it to a strong identity of Aadhaar. So for example, if I am issued a driving license and my Aadhaar is linked, when I open my digital locker account, automatically that would be retrieved from the transport department. So linking Aadhaar is always recommended to retrieve your documents. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to retrieve your document, the digital locker.
It's a great I think it's a great service.
Yes. Yes. So
I have a question, if I may. I understand the DigiLocker issues documents on request. Presumably, do they do that or do they just confirm attributes? Because once the documents are released, then they can be tampered with, presumably, no?
DigiLocker never issues a document. It is the issuer who issues a document. So for example, a transport department would issue an electronic driving license. And you can only see that document in the DigiLocker interface. It's an interface. It's a wallet kind of a thing where you actually see the document. And that document is digitally signed by the transport department. So if it is tampered, then it cannot be validated, verified. So it is digitally signed. It has by the issuer. So if you see the interface, it says that three issued documents. So that means there are three issuers who have issued or one issuer who have issued documents, and it shows a number. When I go there, it will actually show the URIs of those documents. And when I click on the URIs, it will go to the repository and retrieve those documents. So issuer can have complete control on their documents because if they maintain the repository. The document is not transferred, only the URI of that is fetched and showed in the digital locker interface.
So is there a selective disclosure, one? Is there a selective disclosure? Second, is there a revocation? I mean, we understand this is a centralized model to a certain extent. So all the criticisms of centralized models will appear, but does...
Okay, so I would say it cannot be construed as a centralized model, but the interface is centralized because the digital locker never contains a document. It contains the URI, unique resource identifier. It's just a URL of that document. And the repositories, depending on the sensitivity of that, can reside with the issuers themselves. They can actually host a repository. And once a document is requested from the issuer, they can actually check the authentication aspect of from the digital locker service provider, saying that the right person is accessing that document. So the document itself actually resides in the repositories, which can be controlled by issuers themselves, or it can be shared repository. So totally it is decentralized. So there is no if there is a compromise of any digital locker service provider, the only thing compromised are the URIs, unique resource identifiers, which is nothing but a document ID. To retrieve those documents, you have to go to the repositories and fetch them on demand.
The other question is, when I use that document in any context, suppose I get stopped by the cops and I show them my driver's license, Does the issuing authority know that I've been, that the policeman has checked my driver's license?
No, 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 not at all. Not at all. The only digital locker interface which you own has that list. So if you see on the left-hand side, there is a link called activity.
Mm-hmm.
And that activity actually lists which document you have accessed in. And which is your interface.
If what you're sharing from that locker is a URI, then they are requesting that document from the initial issuer, correct?
Yes.
In which case, the initial issuer is going to know everywhere you're sharing that document.
So the requested agency is the digital locker service provider, right? It doesn't have a context whom you are showing to. Okay. So for example, I have to submit a document to say a passport office. So passport office would integrate my digital locker interface in their website or in their whole solution. And when they click, the whole interface opens, which resides in digital locker servers. Technically, every time when I request a document, it would be a digital locker interface, digital locker server. There is no requester server which actually directly talks to a issuer server. So issuer will never know who requested a document.
Okay, go ahead.
They'll just have a log. Basically, it's an audit trail of how many times the document has been requested, but not where exactly the request came from.
Yes, yes.
So who is able to view the log of the digital locker service?
Okay, now there is an activity log. So one, the person who owns that digital locker wallet, wallet. And of course, probably if our digital locker service provider operations team possibly, and of course, there are guidelines around it. There is something called a digital locker authority, which is a regulatory entity of federal government. Any entity who wants to become a digital locker service provider, right now it is only the government who is a digital locker service provider, has to abide by certain rules of privacy. There are stringent penal actions if you breach those privacies. So it is totally regulated entity, digital locker service provider.
They can those documents can be subpoenaed or for a police investigation, for example.
We haven't reached at that stage, but possibly yes. I mean, could have those authorities.
Okay.
But again, just to clarify, the document that you get, for example, the driving license, it appears as a PDF of your official driving license, or is it just a set of attributes that are
okay?
The attributes that you would find in your driving license.
So the proposed document is a PDF. It appears as a PDF, and in some of the documents they have proposed, it can be a JSON or a XML file as well. But most of the documents as of now are in a PDF form, so that you can download it and you can share it with the requesters.
Okay. So is it a signed PDF?
Yes, it is.
According to PDF standard, ISO 32000.
I'm not sure about the standard, but it's a signed PDF with a valid digital signature stamped on it.
Yeah, you can continue the presentation.
Yeah. So here you see there are like, for example, if you say you want to get it, so you select a entity from which you want to actually retrieve the document, and then the document is retrieved. You have to, of course, give certain parameters to fetch the document, like a driving license number, date of birth, or Aadhaar. So That's why it will search in the repository and bring it to you whether that this thing is there or not. And so in the architecture, if you see, it is completely distributed architecture where you can have multiple issuers, you can have multiple repository providers, you can have multiple digital locker service providers, and issuers are free to align with any digital locker service provider, or they can host their own repositories depending on the documents they store, or they can actually outsource it to a third-party repository provider. So all permutation combination is possible. There is no single point where you collect the data and keep it. There is no central registry there, central data store where you keep it, and so it removes the vulnerability of getting it compromised. Of course, the identity providers, the digital locker authority strongly recommends Aadhaar as a strong identity provider, but it accepts mobile and PAN as well. Aadhaar is strongly recommended because a lot of issuers, when they issue Aadhaar-based documents, they are very sure that there is an authentication process post which you can actually retrieve those documents. However, mobile, you can use OTP, and PAN is a weak identity. PAN is a permanent account number, which is an income tax number. Our income tax authority actually issues. So it does not have an authentication factor there. But mobile is OTP, and Aadhaar is, of course, you can do Aadhaar authentication. It is, again, you can upload your legacy documents, and there are e-sign service providers which are already tied up with the digital locker service provider, and you can sign those documents, self-sign those documents. So what are the APIs? Okay, so one API is, so the first API they have actually proposed. Okay, let me start with the meta APIs. So get issuers actually allows you to get list of all issuers registered with the regulator, which is a digital locker authority. Get lockers provides a list of all digital locker service providers. There are a certain set of document types which are defined. You can get those using get document types, and then you can actually get document lookup attributes. This is basically to actually search the document in case they are not linked with Aadhaar number or issuers have suggested that you provide me more attributes. So these are the metadata. Metadata APIs, and then you have the digital locker APIs where you pushed URI, which actually allow issuers to push the URI of the document to the digital locker. So once you store it in the repository, you get a URI and you push this URI onto the digital locker. So you can, if there are multiple digital lockers, you can actually issuer can tie up with one digital locker and just push that URI of the document. Pull document is once you have a URI, you can pull that document, and this is done usually by the digital locker service provider on the request of user. I'll come to the sequence diagram so it would be more clear. Find URI, it actually pulls all URIs from all digital lockers. So typically, once there is a system where there are 5 to 6 digital locker service providers, there might be a possibility that some of the URIs might be available with one issuer, one digital locker service provider, and some might be with other for the same user. So every time there is a request, what are the documents related to me, I can find those documents from all the digital locker service providers. Then fetch document is again a request to fetch document from the digital locker service provider post user contact. So pull doc and fetch doc are two linked kind of sequenced process, where fetch actually is initiated by requester and pull is initiated by digital locker. Get locker token is a consent token, which actually gets the consent, actually confirms the consent. So I'll just come to that sequence diagram. Is it visible?
Yes.
Okay. So so if you see from the top, there is a request registration and you get a unique requested ID, and this is with a particular DigitalLocker service provider. And similarly, you have an issuer which is registered with a DigitalLocker. DLSP is DigitalLocker service provider, and you get a unique issuer ID. And there is a central registry called NDLD, which actually is nothing but a list of requesters and issuers available and a DLSP available in the ecosystem that is controlled by a federal agency. It is nothing but a registry, simple registry. Now, when a user visits a mobile app or a web app or a point of service of requester, requester can be an entity who is providing certain service. Requester might need certain document from the user. So requester would actually say, okay, I need XYZ document from you, and it would open the login or authentication page of the DLSP, DigitalLocker service provider. Okay, now DLSP actually, once a user logs in, shows him a list of all the URIs, and the all the URIs, how it does is it actually connects. It gets all the list of the lockers from the federal authority, and based on that, it actually pings all the DigitalLockers available in the system and gets all the URIs. So fetching document URIs from all DigitalLocker service providers is the process which follows. Once all the URIs are listed, user selects a particular URI, gives a consent, and then DLSP can actually pull that document. Okay, is it clear?
Yes. I mean, basically, it seems very similar to some of the ways in which you can de-link the requester and the issuer through the use of this virtual DLSP.
Yes.
It is used. It's basically used in many other sort of contexts. I mean, similar architectures. Let me put it that way. You know, this is a working system. What about the integration of, I mean, consent is also part of this, and consent interaction happens with the DLSP. So DLSP is more like a wallet, right?
You can say that. You can say that, exactly. It's more like a wallet. It's more like a traffic policeman, which actually manages the entire integration with requester and issuer. So all the document flows through DLSP. Requesters actually connect with DLSP, issuers connect with DLSP, and user actually maintains their URIs in DLSP. So it becomes a central piece.
But you're saying it's basically a virtual piece that is distributed across multiple, but there is the centralizing glue, which is the registries maintained by the federal department. So there is that central repository, which, you know, I know that we are going to have somebody talk about some of these, let's say, shortcomings or whatever you want to call them, challenges of the system with the typical DID system, maybe in the coming weeks, and we'll have an interesting debate about those things. But in the meantime, can you push on and we can
just references. You can actually visit dla.gov.in. That's a DigitalLocker authority. You can actually go to digitallocker.gov.in, which is actually the DigitalLocker. And there are a couple of documents which actually defines the DigitalLocker technology framework and a consent framework. So these are the things which you can actually refer.
So Kalyan wants to ask something.
Yeah, sure.
Maybe we can have this PowerPoint dropped into our system if it is freely shareable. Otherwise, we can just share the DigitalLocker references, right?
Yeah, I'll just check once and I'll share.
Yeah, otherwise we can just share those, you know, the references and some of the ideas.
Sure.
Next week, I mean, next time, which is going to be on December 11th, I guess. Yes. We will have Daryl O'Donnell presenting digital wallets from a completely different viewpoint, of course, and it will be based on the decentralized piece, and it will be based more on the current thought processes in the SSI community. The point that is great about this system is it is a working system, right? And it services thousands of people, or millions, or even one would even say billion and a quarter people, you know. So the question would be, how do we roll back some of the problems that people see? How do we, reverse some of the irreversible processes? Already with the consent layer, we are seeing some of that pushback from the Supreme Court, privacy angle. The other question is, how does it link with the FATF level of assurance, for example? How does it integrate into things like Indy, which I know that Ironworks works on, and they can probably provide us with a better feeling for that? And how much does the government of India or the UIADI consent to this privacy, protection, enhancement of privacy protection? Because on the one hand, we have this huge working system. On the other hand, we know that certain things are a challenge to those systems based on the current thoughts in SSI. So how does, how are we going to address that? And also, of course, the integration into blockchain is our main concern as well. So hopefully we will address many of those issues here. By the way, in terms of biometrics, we had a presentation back 2 years ago on how to do fuzzy matching and biometrics and blockchain, the link is on the Identity Working Group main page. Anybody else has any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. And also, many thanks to Stefan and to Nitin for showing up and presenting. It's always wonderful to hear people who are well-versed in the systems talking about these rather than, it helps inform all of us. Thank you. Anything else, please connect on the mailing list.
Vipin, I'd like to say really quick, if everyone would take a look at the Sovereign Foundation Guardianship White Paper that was published this week. It's on the agenda under the fourth bullet.
Yeah, we forgot to go over the ongoing events because we always keep our finger on the pulse of things like Sovereign, everything else that's happening out there, including, go ahead.
Looks very interesting. I started reading it. Looks great.
The agenda link, Kalia, was posted on the mailing list several times and is always in the same place. jump off from the wiki.hyperledger.org. So sorry that it wasn't. In fact, we were not even supposed to interact on the Zoom chat, but we nonetheless end up doing. I'll put it there because Zoom chat is ephemeral. That is the whole problem. And Rocket Chat is not. Anyway. All right, guys. I'm going to put the link on Zoom chat before we close, and then we will close the meeting. Okay.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Vipin.
Thanks.
Thank you, Vipin, and everyone. Hi. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Good night.
Thank you,
everyone.